Good. Well, let me, just as the Bibles are coming round, just remind you that we have been introducing Jesus and Christianity to you over these last few Sunday evenings. So who is Jesus? Why did he come? And what does he demand of us? We've thought of Jesus' identity, who he is. We've thought of his mission. And we've thought of the, and we'll think tonight, of the crucial choice that he brings to all of us. Tonight we're going to look at this crucial choice and thinking of the whole idea of the choice that we will all have to face. It's our response to the call or the demands that Jesus makes on all of our lives. I don't know if you ever thought about what a Christian is. Basically, a Christian is someone who knows who Jesus is, has accepted why he's come, and has responded to the demands or the call that Jesus makes on them, whatever the cost. That's what a Christian is. That's what the Bible says a Christian is. And in Mark chapter 8, that's page 734 if you're in the Blue Bible, 734, or page 26 if you're in the Mark's Gospel. So we're going to look at Mark chapter 8 tonight and just work our way through some of the verses in this passage and just see Mark remind us of who Jesus is, why he came, and then see this incredible crucial choice we have as we think of the demand that he brings upon our lives and whatever the cost. And so if you have page 732 open there, and we'll come to that in a moment. What Mark has done up to this point in his gospel is answer the question, who is Jesus? For the seven chapters up to this point, there's been constant evidence to who Jesus is in terms of his identity. And what Mark has wanted us to see, that the answer is absolutely obvious. People should have been seeing, this is God's anointed one. This is the Christ. This is the Son of God. This is the promised one of the Old Testament. This is God in human flesh. That's what Mark was expecting, that we who read it now and those who lived then would be seeing and discovering as we see what Mark writes for us. I don't know if you've ever seen any of these sort of trick pictures. Let's put the first one up. I don't know what you see there as you look at that first trick picture. I guess you can see a nice scene. I don't know if you see the baby, but there's a baby there creating the frame for you to see the nice lake or loch or ocean, whatever it is. Do you see them both? The baby and the scene. Let me give you another trick picture. And what do you see there? Walking in the woods in the autumn, I think, with the leaves on the ground. If you look very carefully, though, you'll see the face of a man as well. These pictures that we look at clearly show two things. Let me show you the final trick picture that I want to give you here. I don't know what you see, and I don't even know if it's politically correct language to use, but there's a beautiful woman there. But sadly, there's a hideous old hag as well. I don't know if you can see either of those. But you know, in a similar way, as we answer the question, who is Jesus? What we discover is that Mark wants us to see that Jesus, if you like, has two faces. He has a human face and he has a divine face. And Mark wants us to see that those two in the first seven chapters of his gospel are absolutely obvious, as plain as being able to see just one thing in those trick pictures. If you have your Bible there, Mark chapter 8 and verses 17 and 18, help us to see Mark drawing the attention, though, to what people actually saw, and probably what many today see as we think of and look at the person of Jesus. Mark chapter 8, verses 17 and 18. Aware of their discussions, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear?" Don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000? How many basketfuls of pieces were left to be picked up? 12, they replied. And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces were left? 7, they answered. Jesus, on the occasion of feeding 5,000 people and 4,000 people, had done the most incredible miracle with a tiny lunch. And even what they picked up afterwards was greater than the lunch that they had started off with. And the disciples had been walking with Jesus, if you like, for those first 7 chapters of Mark. And Jesus had done many things. He had done these amazing healings. He had raised people from the dead. He had fed all these people from a tiny lunch, and there was more left over than they began with. But sadly, it was as though they were still blind. That's what it says. They couldn't hear, they couldn't see, they couldn't get it. And sometimes when we think of Jesus, we only see the human face. We don't often see the divine face. It's quite striking. Mark continues his gospel account with the incident of a healing of a blind man. Let's continue to read from verse 22. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. And when he had spat on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." And once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And Jesus sends him home. This miracle is quite unique in the miracles of Jesus. It's not that somehow Jesus has lost his power for a moment and isn't able to perform the miracle. But it happens gradually, the opening of this man's eyes. The blind man sees something from seeing nothing, and then eventually he sees absolutely everything. You know, the only way that any of us will move from seeing nothing about Jesus to seeing something about Jesus, to seeing everything about Jesus, is if Jesus is the one who opens not our physical eyes, but our spiritual eyes to see the two faces of Jesus. And it's quite likely what Mark has done here by putting this miracle here is to remind us of this great parallel of the gradual opening of our sight. And maybe you've been coming to room 65 and you've learned something about Jesus and you've been intrigued and you've learned more about Jesus. Then that's not because we've become more intelligent or used our intelligence or ingenuity to understand it. It's because he's done a work in us to help us to grasp it. The disciples themselves actually take a step closer as we continue to read to understanding the two faces of Jesus. Let's continue to read from verse 27. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he said. "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Christ." And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. There's a big step taking place here for the disciples. Finally, they've recognized Jesus' identity. They've understood that he's not just human, but he's God. That's what Peter says when he says, "You're the Christ." He's understood that this is God in human flesh. Jesus asked them a scorching question. Not just the question, "What does everybody else say?" but "What do you say?" And in a sense, as we read Mark's gospel, it becomes personal to us as well. We're asked the question, so who do we see Jesus is? Who do we see Jesus to be? Everything that's been sung about and said tonight is a reminder of the fact that we have a living Jesus who died and rose again and is continuing to work in people's lives by his Spirit in our generation. And so who is he? And verse 30 is such an interesting wee verse here when Jesus warns them not to go and tell anyone about him. Of course, the reason for that is they may have got Jesus' identity right. They may have understood absolutely clearly who Jesus was. But the problem now is that as Jesus begins to reveal more of who he is and what he's come to do, it's obvious they don't understand or accept what he's come to do. And so why did he come? You see, in verse 30, What is beginning to happen is that they've seen something, but they've not seen everything yet. And so there would be no point of them going out and telling the story of Jesus if it was only a half-cocked story. They would have to tell the whole thing, and they would have to understand the whole thing before they could go and tell anybody the whole truth. And so Jesus, in verses 31 and 32, begins to explain more about what he's come to do. He began to teach them that the Son of Man, it's just another title he uses for himself, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he spoke plainly about this. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. And so Jesus begins to address their partial vision. He begins to say, let me show you the whole truth. And poor Peter jumps in to prove that he's only still partially sighted. He says, you know, Jesus, I understand who you are, but if you're going to tell me that this is the way that you prove your kingship, I don't agree. And it was obviously pretty serious, because Jesus turns to Peter and actually calls him the devil in human flesh. So it was a pretty serious issue that poor Peter had not quite got the whole story. In a way, though, can we blame Peter? I mean, surely if Jesus was claiming to become the king that would rule, he needed to be alive and he needed to be on a throne. He didn't need to die and go to a cross. And so poor Peter was perplexed. He hadn't understood it all. And in many occasions, we can remain perplexed unless we begin to see, as God comes and shows us Jesus through the person and work of the Spirit who's living today. You know, there are two ways really to see the cross. To see it from man's perspective or to see it from God's perspective. Poor Peter saw it from man's perspective here, from the human point of view. And of course, if we look at the cross of Jesus Christ from the human perspective or from the human point of view, of course Jesus seems to be terribly exposed. Of course Jesus seems to be humiliated and defeated. The cross seems to prove conclusively that Jesus got lots of things right, but he obviously got some things wrong. If he was the Son of God, why didn't he come down from the cross to save his life? Surely a king should be sitting on a gold throne in a palace and not dying on a wooden gibbet. But you see, if we look at the cross from another angle, from God's perspective, and if our minds as human beings move from thinking in terms of man's way, but thinking in terms of the things of God, then we begin to see that the cross is the most incredible rescue plan that has ever existed. We can see there that it's there that God chooses to use Jesus to rescue us or to bring us back into relationship with the God that has been broken because of the things that we've done. He chooses this to be his rescue mission. You see, the rescued cannot dictate the terms of rescue to the rescuer. You know, that would be ludicrous. When the rescuer comes, we just give him our hand and say, take me out of this building. Take me out of this ocean. Take me from this place that was never created for human beings, hell, and rescue me for heaven. And so when we see things from God's perspective, we see Jesus executed, taking the punishment for crimes that he had never committed for us. That's why it happened. It's the most powerful moment in the whole of history. And because of who Jesus is, and for the very reason that he came, we then discover that Jesus, having done those two things, showing himself, telling us why he's come, has the absolute divine right to make a demand on us as human beings. You see, it's not enough just to recognize who Jesus is, but we need to grasp why he came, and we need to be willing to respond to his call or the demand that he makes on our lives, whatever it costs. Now look at verse 34 as we continue to read the passage. And then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. You see, the demand that Jesus makes for us here is a demand to change allegiance. To deny self isn't giving up cream eggs for Easter. It's far more serious than that. You know, the God of the universe chose in the person of Jesus to display himself as God and to do something for us that we could never do for ourselves. That many people through history have scoffed at, and yet it's the most amazing event in history. And so he realized that something was serious enough to come and do something about it. And so to simply say that denying self is giving up cream eggs for Easter is not serious enough. Denying self means to no longer live for ourselves. It's to stop living independently of God. That's what living for ourselves is all about. Living independently of God. You know, the God who made us, the God who sustains us. Actually, although we may recognize it or not, the God who allows us to live tonight. You know, denying self means recognizing the absolute absurdity of living as somehow we were the ultimate authority. You know, the Bible uses a small word called sin. And one of the ways the Bible describes the word sin is our lives as human beings living with the big I in the middle of sin independently of God, separating ourselves from God. Or to live as though somehow we were the ultimate authority. It's ludicrous, isn't it? To think that the one that Chris read of earlier, who has created the world as his footstool, and somehow we think that we play our small part on that footstool, are the ultimate authority for the universe. And yet that's what the Bible says our lives are like. And so the Bible tells us we need to repent. We need to turn from independent living to totally dependent living upon God. It's called changing allegiance. It's saying, Jesus, I recognize who you are, and I will allow you to take charge. The second thing Jesus says here is not just a call to allegiance, but a call to die. Look at the rest of verse 34. He doesn't just say, deny yourself. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself. He says, take up the cross and follow me. And this is not just a cross to bear. Sadly, in the world, there are some horrible things are happening. And people find pain and the hurt and the suffering of living in this world of ours. But just simply to say we have a cross to bear, that is nothing like as serious and as painful as what Jesus was about to go through and what he wants us to understand about the reality of the call to die. You know, remember at this point, Jesus is going to the cross. And so it's a little disturbing to realize that he immediately turns his attention from his cross to what we have to do. Jesus wasn't into self-promotion. Jesus wasn't into self-preservation. He was into total self-sacrifice. And he realizes that as human beings, we are prone to want to self-promote ourselves. We want to self-preserve ourselves. And not be willing to surrender to one who's willing to surrender his life for us. In the early years of the 20th century, the explorer Ernest Shackleton put an advert in various London newspapers to try and find men who would come with him on a polar expedition. And here's what the advert said. Men wanted for a hazardous journey. Small wages, bitter cold, long months in complete darkness, constant danger, safe return, doubtful. Needless to say, there weren't many applicants. And yet Jesus' appeal is similar. It's come and die. Jesus said, unless a grain of seed falls to the ground and dies, it won't produce any more life. And Jesus takes a tiny seed and says, look at the way that the Creator, or he even is the Creator, has produced the seed in such a way that when it dies in the ground, it produces life. John in his gospel put it this way when Jesus speaks, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified," says Jesus. "I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds." And yes, Jesus is talking of his own death, but he's talking about what has to happen in our lives as we surrender all that we are to all that he is. There has to be the dying. There has to be the pain. That's often why people become Christians in really hard times. Because at that point, I think it was C.S. Lewis said it, it's like a megaphone blaring at us that God is there to help. Of course, come and die. Isn't Jesus saying that all of his followers will face a violent death, as he did, although sadly throughout history, Christians have, because of where they've found themselves living. Followers, though, can find themselves marginalised. We can find ourselves misunderstood. We can find ourselves frozen out or isolated. Sometimes our friends and our family and our colleagues find our beliefs uncomfortable and sometimes even offensive. To stand up in our generation and to say Jesus is the only way, the only truth, the only life, the only way to God. And so, you know, if a Christian is someone who clearly understands who he is and why he came, and to follow him whatever the cost, we have to think about the cost. And Jesus knows that. Jesus knows that we need to think seriously before we commit our lives to him. And so he gives us this incredible, convincing reason. "For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul?" You see, the convincing reason is focused on the future. Jesus doesn't want to just talk in terms of earthly things and the cost of earthly things, because if we do that, we'll be caught up in the things and we won't have the right perspective. He wants to see that inside of us, God has placed a soul. Something that lives on after we've died. It's the most precious part of us. It was created as the otherworldly part of us for another world in heaven. But without Jesus' rescue, we won't find that place there. And so what Jesus says for us here is that we're not to look on our present circumstances. We shouldn't look as people often do, and probably as we often do, look at the present things. Do they pay dividends now? But rather we're to lift our eyes and look at the future. You know, what the Bible actually says to us here is that what we do now has an eternal consequence. Jesus teaches that there's a connection between how we live and what will happen after death. That's why this is a convincing reason. Because Jesus is saying, take our eyes off the circumstances of life and picture what the circumstances of eternity are. And of course, there's this interesting wee twist that appears here to grab our attention. Because he says, if we try and save our lives, we'll lose them. Well, that's almost ludicrous, because I'm into self-preservation. Why is it if I try and save my life, I'll lose it? But that's what Jesus says will happen. But those who are prepared to lose their lives, he says, will gain them. You see, Jesus well knows that we want to cling on to our lives, to cling on to life, to do what we want to do, when we want to do it. And nobody else can tell us otherwise. But what he does here is warn us that if we live that way, then ultimately we will lose the very thing we're desperate to cling on to. He tells us that the only way to hold on to our lives is if we're willing to allow our lives to be taken over under his control. In 1000 AD, 180 years after the death of the famous Emperor Charlemagne, officers of Emperor Otto's empire reopened Charlemagne's tomb. Before them was an extraordinary sight. In the midst of all the finery buried with them, the gold, the jewels, the priceless treasure, there was a skeleton of Charlemagne himself, seated on a throne, wearing his crown, and in his lap a Bible. Open at Mark chapter 8, verse 36. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? What was Charlemagne answering God when he looked at that text? You know, Mark chapter 8, verse 38 says this: "If anyone is ashamed of me, says Jesus, and my words, in this adulterous and sinful generation, then Jesus says he will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory." You see, what the Bible tells us here and what Jesus wants us to understand, that Jesus is judge, whether we like it or not. But this judge is also our rescuer. And ultimately, we will be treated fairly. What Jesus says here is that the way that we have treated him, he will treat us. He's only confirming the choice that we've made in this life. Matthew, in his record, puts it this way of Jesus' words: "Whoever acknowledges me before others, I will acknowledge before my Father in heaven. But whoever disowns me before people, I will disown before my Father in heaven." The Bible makes it clear that God gives us free will and choice. And he says, the way that you treat me is how I'll treat you then. Is that not fair? Is that not fair? And so one day when we face Jesus, who knows whether we've acknowledged him before people or not, through the cross though, has still come to give us the opportunity of having the sting of that judgment removed as Jesus takes it. He says, "I'm your judge, but I'm your rescuer as well." And so the good news of the gospel is that acknowledging Jesus as our judge, and we need to, and accepting him as our rescuer now, will mean that then, and only through that way, will be accepted before God. Let me just finish by saying this. You know, because Jesus is that person who will judge this world and judge our lives, surely then it's not a crazy gesture to entrust our lives and our deaths into his hands. In doing so, says Jesus, we'll find our life saved, preserved. And surely anything that we would lose in this life will just pale into insignificance when we consider what awaits us then. Call it Jesus' demand of our life, the cross, or call it Jesus' plea to our lives to give up the very things that destroy us, our self-love, our self-worship, our self-will. Jesus says, "Let me rescue you from yourself. Don't waste your soul." And his demand then is a plea. He says, "Let me take hold of your life. My plea," he says, "is to let me be your rescuer." And I guess my plea to you tonight, is would you acknowledge that Jesus is judge, but would you also recognize that he is your rescuer? And if you do, when you stand before him that day, then he'll accept you. Don't waste your soul. Hand your soul, your life, your all, entrusted into the one who has come to rescue us from ourselves, from hell, for heaven. May God bless you. And if you want to find out more about this gospel message, please take Mark's gospel. If you would like to talk to someone, I would be delighted to talk more to you about it. I think we're just going to hand back to the musicians as they just pull things to a close for us. Thank you.